Welcome to Between Two Ovaries, your go-to for all things women's health.
A lot of people just say like, oh, my vagina.
Yeah.
And yes. That's all of the above.
That's not your vagina.
No.
Well, it is.
We're here to cut through the confusion, bust some myths, and give you the facts straight from the experts.
You cannot still believe the amount of people that come to a gynecology clinic saying that they don't look right down there and they need something doing about it.
We're keeping it real, bringing you honest conversations about topics that matter to you.
Everything goes back to the menstrual cycle.
Yes. It's a low-risk procedure, but it's not a no-risk procedure.
From periods to menopause and everything in between, we've got you covered.
So whether you're here to learn, laugh, or just listen, you are in the right place.
As soon as I said it.
Great. So, hello, everyone. So it's a pleasure to introduce Naga Munchetti, distinguished journalist and presenter on BBC Breakfast and also BBC Radio 5 Live's Time of the Month. She's an avid golfer, an advocate for women's health, and she's openly shared her experience of her journey with adenomyosis. So we met last year, joined her research for her book, It's Probably Nothing. And I was honoured to contribute some of my experience with my adenomyosis research alongside other pioneers in women's health and brave women sharing their personal stories about their women's health topics. So Naga's advocacy for change in women's health has inspired countless others to speak up and seek better care, and we're very excited to have her on this episode. So Welcome, Naga.
Welcome.
Thank you
for coming. We're going to just like go straight into this because we've got loads of questions and we want to try and get through as many as possible, please. So we want to firstly try and discuss about your experience of adenomyosis. So we know that you're a super busy person and we'd like to know how you manage to balance between your public persona as a journalist and the vulnerability of sharing like such personal health struggles, because it's quite like diverse between them. So we want to know what you thought about that.
I think as a journalist, your instinct, because the job is to tell stories, tell people's stories. And so your instinct is to facilitate people telling their stories or to, how shall we say, persuade people to tell their stories if they're reluctant storytellers. And by that, I mean, you know, interviews with perhaps politicians and get them to tell you things. But you are never the story. When I spoke on Five Live, Radio 5 Live, about my coil fitting, it was because Catelyn Moran had written about it. And everything she said had resonated with me. And I'd kind of told my team about my own experience. And the editor at the time said, you should talk about this. And I was like, absolutely not.
Yeah.
Absolutely not. I'm not going to talk about, you know, how a speculum hurt and how my smear tests had hurt and how I'd had this coil fitting and nothing had been resolved. But we did it in such a way where, one, we didn't denigrate the use of the coil, the IUD, because, of course, it is a fantastic piece of contraception and hormone treatment.
Yeah.
But we did it in a way where we opened up the floor, so to speak, for people to bring their own experiences. And when we did that, we changed guidelines in terms of pain relief for women because of the noise we made and because of the noise Catelyn Moran had initially made. And when I was diagnosed with adenomyosis, we'd seen that on the NHS website, there was one link, NHS England website, there was one link, one mention of adenomyosis, and the link was straight to hysterectomy. And I'm not bothered about talking about what my body does. I'm not ashamed of having periods. I'm not ashamed of having heavy periods. I'm not ashamed of having a vulva, and I'm not ashamed of bleeding heavily or being in pain because of adenomyosis and what my body does. But I think there is a shame, and I think when we decided to talk about it, I'd had really bad experiences of diagnosis, lack thereof, treatment because there's no cure, and because of the lack of money that goes into women's reproductive health in terms of research, as you all well know.
Yeah, unfortunately.
And it felt like, even though it was personal, it felt impersonal because it was the issue that was the problem. not me. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You've managed to kind of like move it from one side to another, haven't you? Kind of make it a story, and it is about you, but you're trying to kind of tell other people so that they feel empowered to tell their story.
Mm-hmm. Even to this day, I get emails and letters and posts on social media with women telling me how they've been ignored, what they're going through, how they're trying to be heard, how they've been pushed from pillar to post, or basically told there is no cure, not just for adenomyosis, endometriosis, PCOS, and not just reproductive health issues, you know, women's health issues. And in some ways, it was those experiences and presenting that time of the month on Five Live, which is one segment of the shows I do. We do this once a month. That made me realise that there was something to be said about the system of medicine, the treatment of women, the understanding of women's health, and also arming women to be able to ask and, if needs be, demand the right treatment and the healthcare they deserve.
And that's exactly why we do this podcast as well, because obviously me and Nick are both clinical, so we do work with patients, but we can see so often how women are not able to advocate for themselves because there's such stigma associated with the symptoms and the conditions they have, and also such a lack of knowledge on how to do that.
The lack of knowledge is just immense. Like, people just don't understand their own bodies and their potential treatments, and they just hear bad stories. And I love the fact that you were saying you didn't think that the coil was a bad idea for everybody. And yeah, it might be a bad idea for some people, but it's amazing for so many people. And that's the kind of, we wanted to just get good information out there, and that's great that you're kind of getting balanced information out there.
Yeah,
of course. And with the coil, it wasn't actually about the coil itself. I never spoke about how it was having the coil. It was the fitting,
the experience of getting it.
The
experience of being fitted. So it wasn't about, it's not about this medicine or this treatment is good or bad. It's the treatment of women being treated.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Definitely. So we know that lots of people have different symptoms that relate to adenomyosis. Could you give us a bit of a run through of your experience and like your day to day with adenomyosis?
Okay, so I started my periods at 15, and that involved flooding, diarrhea, fainting, extreme cramps, and the fainting was through pain, dizziness, cramps in my legs, in my thighs, in my lower back. And periods that lasted 10 to 10 days and then started again 10 days after. So frequent, heavy, all consuming, is how it felt and how it always felt. And basically just putting up with it. Went on the pill, have been on the pill, had the depot injection, depot Provera, tried the coil. I'm now, as a perimenopausal woman, on a mixture of HRT and more progesterone to stop the bleeding, but still have pain. Was diagnosed at 47. And people say, oh, wasn't it great when you were diagnosed? Well, no, not really. Because there's no cure. It's just like, you know, it's like being told, oh yeah, you've got this, great, what are you gonna do about it? Hysterectomy, no, that's not the answer. Hysterectomy is not the answer to everything. Excision is not the answer to everything, because the adeno, and I may well have endometriosis as well, has spread throughout my hips and my lower back. So unless you're going to remove those and eliminate any risk of the endometrium reacting to my hormone changes, which will happen forever, you ain't getting rid of it. So that's my journey.
Yeah, and it highlights really well how the focus should be on managing your symptoms and what is affecting your life and what's important to you, not just, oh, well, we can cut out something that we think might cause you symptoms, so let's get on and do that. It's a much more holistic approach that needs to be taken for women who have these symptoms.
I think it's interesting that you said actually the diagnosis kind of didn't help, because I think we try to let people know that a diagnosis isn't going to change things in a lot of ways, and it's to get a treatment or get a mixture of treatments that ensure that you can live your best life all the time, as much of the time as possible, rather than be like, you've got this, which means we can do X, Y, and Z. Because as you said, there isn't an X, Y, and Z for these. There is just treatments to help with things. And yeah, removing your womb will treat your adenomyosis, but you would still have endometriosis. And as you said, removing everything endometriosis wise, if you're going to take hormones like estrogen in HRT, that's not going to help with your endometriosis, so you're still going to have the pain from that. So it's really a difficult kind of, there isn't a good option. And I think we spend a lot of time chatting about, there isn't a, this is going to fix you, therefore we need to think about all the things that could possibly help.
Yeah, and this is where research really will come in. So I mean, obviously I did a 3-year PhD on adenomyosis, and at the end of it I felt like I knew less than I did at the beginning, because there's just so much to learn. But what all women's health and specifically conditions like adenomyosis need is new treatments that are not just focused on cutting things out, because that's not perfect for everyone. It's not always an option and it's not always safe.
No.
But we need treatments that actually target the disease itself. So we need to learn more about the disease. I could go on for hours about this. More about the disease to be able to identify better ways to treat it. But on treatments, because some people listening will be at the start of their journey or will be experiencing symptoms and wondering what they should have. Everyone's experience is different, but was there a particular treatment that you found actually really helped your symptoms over the years?
Oh yeah, for me it was the Depo Provera.
Yeah, okay.
That was everything to me. I didn't bleed, therefore I didn't have periods, I didn't have pain. Honestly, it was for 10 years I was leaping about like that old sanitary period product advert,
yeah,
where you could, you know, do anything, you know. And I think I realised, and I remember, I very rarely cry, but I remember being told I wasn't going to be able to have it anymore, because I think I reached 41, 42, and they said, you're at risk of osteoporosis.
Mm.
And I was like, well, I'm not, because look at my numbers, yeah, look at my tests, I'm not. And I exercise, I do this, but it was, yeah, like, again, computer says this without looking, yeah, at you holistically. Yeah, I can see your face.
It's,
and
really,
we're all
difficult.
Individuals, yeah?
Yeah, it's frustrating.
And I remember being really angry and just said, if you take me off this, I know what's going to happen. No, you're older, it'll be fine. It happened. Mm, I, yeah, started having periods again and being in pain, which is why I tried alternative treatments. Mm. But the Depo was the answer for me. But then, you know, look, I've got friends who went on the Depo and had awful mood swings.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we're all affected by,
yeah,
and weight gain, and we're all affected by things differently. Mm. The pill didn't really help, because I was told when I was younger, well, I was told you have to bleed, which you don't have,
no,
to.
No,
and you know, that, I don't know why that myth is being kind of enforced.
We try,
it's
honestly, we really try and push this.
It's,
you,
bonkers,
do not need to have a period. Like, it's,
no,
yeah,
no. And I was told that, so that didn't help. And you know, you could, and also my shift, the way I work, my shifts, you know, I'm all over the place. So I needed, the Depo just meant, like, now I take progesterone pill as well as my HRT treatment, but I have to set an alarm, and I,
yeah,
found that at one point in the day where I know I won't be on air or I won't be asleep, and you know, and I set that alarm every day. But the Depo was amazing,
yeah,
for me, but I know, yeah, it's caused loads of, you know, it hasn't worked for loads of other people,
yeah.
So it there is very much a suck it and see type attitude.
There is. And it's also, that kind of feeds into you also, again, needing to be able to have some knowledge to advocate for yourself, because it kind of should be a discussion where, if you're aware of the risks and benefits and you've individualised them to yourself, then potentially you could go against guidelines with the right clinician. Mm. But often I think people are, especially with women's health,
yeah,
just sort of told a black and white yes or no. Which is really difficult then if something has helped you for so long.
Yeah, mm-hmm, that's exactly what I was going to say. And I think things are changing sometimes with regards to kind of, we know that, yes, potentially 70-year-olds shouldn't be on HRT, but if they've made the decision that actually their life is so much better living well on HRT and they're on the lowest dose that's effective for them and they know of the risks, then it's that risk v benefit situation. Like, how does it affect you? Do you have any other risk factors? Do you exercise? Are you overweight? Do you smoke? Have you got cardiovascular history? There's
yeah,
lots of things to take into that kind of stratification, and a computer says no, it's just
so frustrating.
So frustrating.
Yeah. No, so during your journey, has there been any like really positive experiences within healthcare that you've thought actually that really stands out? Because obviously the NHS does get quite a bad rep sometimes.
I am not criticising the NHS in the slightest. My criticism is of the lack of understanding and research and also education offered to girls and boys. Because that's why we don't know how to advocate for ourselves. That's why we don't understand how our hormones work unless you read a book about it or you're told about it. And even then, it's still such a bizarre way, such a bizarre thing. I'm not criticising the NHS, nor have I done. The NHS is an institution and it is going through its own issues in terms of waiting lists, staffing, pay disputes. That is that as a business, as a, you know, as an institution. People who work for the NHS, I've said they are puzzle solvers. I think medics, scientists, they're puzzle solvers. And when you solve a puzzle from the, you know, from dot, when you figure out how to open your eyes and, you know, when you have a jigsaw puzzle when you're six and you fit the pieces in or you figure out how to say what, that brings immense delight to all human beings. And I've always said that the part that the relationship you have with your GP, your initial point of contact, and then any consultants, whatever, should be a partnership. You have to give them the information for them to be able to solve the puzzle. You can't go in saying, I don't feel well, and expect them to spend those 10 minutes, particularly with GPs on the NHS, and say, right, let me ask you a good question onto the book. Go in with information and be armed. I have had positive experiences. Of course I had. I had a woman when I kept having recurring thrush who finally told me that there was a pill I could pop rather than messing around with pessaries and creams, which a different doctor had repeatedly prescribed, even though I said they're not working. The moment I took this pill, within a day I was fine. I was like, why has this been hidden from me? You know, the gatekeeping.
I read that in your book and it's just like, it's just so frustrating, because as someone who's works in the NHS, has worked in the NHS for a long time, like, we really try, we want to be good. And I just think if you don't know the answer, refer to somebody else. I'm very like, especially in fertility, and people have read about X, Y, and Z that might help. And I'm just like, give me a second to read up about that, because that is something that I have not heard of. And if it's helped you, or if you think it might help and it's not dangerous, then 100% we should have a go. And I think it's that, just the open dialogue. And I think people trust you more if you are open and you say, that might not help, but that might, and you set some expectations. This is going to take at least 3 months to help, or this might take up to 6 months. I think it's that kind of making sure that people are aware of the plan moving forward. But yeah, it's, if you don't know the answer, ask somebody else. Like, it's not rocket science.
It's a partnership, as you said, Nagra, and that's what it should be. Like, we've moved away from this paternalistic, this is the treatment for this, this is what you must do. And now it's much more important to listen and work with the patients as well, rather than just following a guideline and doing what you think you should.
And it doesn't need to be like one doctor to one patient partnership. It can be like a group of multifaceted. You've got people that can help with this and people that can help with that.
Definitely.
So I think you touched on like the problem solving, and that's a huge thing obviously in research. There's obviously a lack of research into new treatments for all of the women's health conditions really, and we just sort of wondered what changes you thought would be most beneficial and what you'd, you know, really like to see prioritised.
Well, I don't understand why 51% of the population are not considered important enough so that there's less than 2.5% of public funding into women's reproductive health. The equation just doesn't make sense to me. I've met people like you. I've met you, you know, pushing to get your research heard and funded. I don't understand why we are not sexy science. I don't understand.
Do you know, it's funny that you've just said that, because we had someone in a PPI group the other day that said, I think the problem is in women's health that it's not sexy, whereas she said that she felt like breast cancer was sexy, and then when she went to a breast cancer clinic, she felt like everything was done and everything was really well aligned. But she said when she came to something and she actually ended up being diagnosed with endometrial cancer, she felt like it just wasn't, it wasn't talked about, she didn't tell anyone about it, she'd left her bleeding for a long time, whereas she felt like with the, when she'd had breast cancer, it was more of like a sexy thing, and it was more at the forefront of people's minds, and she got kind of that diagnosis much quicker, which has given us kind of a lot of food for thought, I think.
Definitely.
I think breasts are beautiful. I mean, all of us are beautiful. Breasts are beautiful. But the aesthetic of being a woman, I think because it's been a paternalistic industry, and I'm talking about medical research and obviously the history of medicine, we have been reduced to image, and our function, our functionality, such as being able to give birth, has only been seen as important when we are wanting to get pregnant or unable to get pregnant or are pregnant. And that is sexy, you know, you can tell me the correct, you know, when you're in utero, like operating in utero, for example.
Sexy. That's definitely sexy medicine.
Breast cancer, you know, the progression of treatment of breast cancer and identification of it or prevention is amazing. But I do feel there is this thing that keep the bleeding quiet because that's just an inconvenience. We don't want to know about it. We don't want to hear about it. Yeah, you ain't going to get the rest of all this fabulous without understanding and making sure that works. And I suppose it's like turning it on its head that this is, you know, our hormones make us wonderful, make us strong, our testosterone, our estrogen, you know, progesterone, our, you know, our brain health, our creativity, our ability to problem solve, our ability to juggle. And I think it would come down to money. The more women that are out of the workplace, the fewer taxes are going to be paid. Less tax will be paid. So, and less GDP will be accumulated. So, you know, talk about what money you're missing out on with all these women who are not being given the treatment they need.
We were discussing as well, we did an episode on chronic pelvic pain earlier, and we were discussing how frustrating it is that there's so much of a stigma attached to chronic pelvic pain, but chronic back pain you talk about and you get help for, and it's not something to be ashamed of. But for some reason, chronic pelvic pain is just as common and not talked about and not invested in as much.
It's almost like, you know, when you see those videos on Instagram where men have the tent, like, I don't know if it's a TENS machine, you know, that machine that stimulates
the cramps,
childbirth or period pain. It's like, oh yeah, it's all very funny and it's great that men are experiencing this and get an idea. But the idea is that it happens and then it's over. So childbirth happens and then it's over. It might happen two or three times, but then it's over. So it's temporary. And period pain, it's over. It's not over. You live in dread of it. You rearrange your life, your social life, your work life, your caring responsibilities. You lose sleep, your ability to function well. It isn't, it's seen as, I appreciate the fact that people experience this or men experience this and show others, gosh, this is unbelievable. But it's still seen as kind of a temporary thing that we just go through once a month and then we can crack on.
Agree. We've kind of touched on this, and that you have done so much for empowering women and for women to advocate for themselves. So the book is pretty much just all about, come on guys, stand up, speak up, be heard. So we'd like to just ask a couple of questions on that, if that's okay. So when we've discussed previously about education, and you've mentioned this as well today, what do you think is missing from current menstrual education, and how can we improve it for future generations so we're not getting to the point where we're in clinic and we can't describe our problems and we're not sure of the treatments? How can we make that better?
Just because it's common doesn't mean it's normal. So if you are bleeding heavily, we need to stop this myth that a period is one or two teaspoons of blood. We need to stop that nonsense right now. We need to talk about why you would use a tampon over a period pad. We need to stop calling them sanitary products. There's nothing unsanitary about having a period. You may feel icky. Why wouldn't you if you had blood, you know, coming out of you and you having to go to the loo more often? We need to understand that diarrhea or constipation is normal when you have a period, because we need to understand what hormones do to our bowels. You know, we need to understand when something is not normal so that we can flag it as early as possible. We need to stop making children feel that puberty, what puberty means is, oh my goodness, you can get pregnant. Yeah. We need to make someone pregnant.
We talked about that, yeah.
We need to make puberty be, this is great, your body is developing, you're winning at life because you've got to puberty, brilliant. Enjoy this because you will see your body do marvellous things, and embrace it because we're all different. But if it doesn't feel good, you need to be able to talk about it. We're all about talking about mental health, particularly during puberty. Absolutely right, yeah. We should. But if it doesn't physically feel right, growing pains is not the should not be the presumption of discomfort. Mm-hmm. I think it starts like that.
Yeah, it's like understanding what is normal to then understand what isn't normal and what you need to get help for, I think. Is really, really key with them.
Keeping a conversation and not pushing. You go through puberty and you're going to get someone pregnant and you're going to get toxic shock syndrome from a tampon. Like, you're just like...
There's more to it.
Yeah, there's more to it than this.
Yeah.
And also, sex. Sex is not bad. Mm-hmm. Teach them how to enjoy sex, what good sex is, and it not be so taboo that... If, for example, you have reproductive health problems that affect your sex life, painful sex, vaginal dryness, anything, let them know what they should be experiencing. Just because you tell children that, I know, cars exist, a child's not going to run out and steal a car or run in the road. Do you know what I mean? And just because you tell children sex exists, and sex happens, they're not all going to run out and have sex.
Mm-hmm. But that's another area where you get that real like disparity between men and women. Everyone has sex, but for some reason it's okay for men to talk about enjoying sex, but for women that's a completely different thing. Yeah. It's such a taboo topic, but men and women have sex together a lot of the time.
You know, it shouldn't be something that's done to you.
No. So I think that education's really good to try and encourage these things being spoken about more openly. Is there anything else that we can do to kind of get it out there and cause a bit of a shift so people can speak about things more openly?
Talk about it when you're out having a coffee without shame. Talk about it in a bar without shame. Talk about it with all your friends. My friends will know when I'm bleeding, if it's bothering me, or if I have period pain. And it wasn't always that way. Yeah. Now it's that way because I'm not going to... Why should I hide it? Someone would tell me if they had a headache or a migraine, or back pain.
Yeah.
Why should I not hide my pain?
I love that,
my friends.
I love that. Basically, the start of this episode, one of the things you said was that you have a vulva and you're not ashamed of it.
Yeah,
that's exactly the kind of thing that we need to talk about.
I feel like this is the sort
break
of thing
that down. Yeah,
we do. Like, we went to get a coffee before coming here, and we'll just chat about things all the time. Yeah. So.
So I think, sort of tying into that, especially like touching on how much support we get from friends, what advice would you give to people's, you know, partners, family members, friends, who want to support someone who's got adenomyosis or a similar condition and, you know, they're struggling with it?
I think this applies to everyone. Mm-hmm. Just find out more about things you don't know. Be curious. If someone says they have a condition, ask about it.
Yeah.
If someone said they have it, yeah, obviously ask. Do you want to talk about it?
Yeah.
You know, what can I do to help? What can I do to support you? And do you know what? Sometimes it is as simple as getting a hot water bottle.
Yeah.
Other times, as in my case, it's calling an ambulance and saying, no, she can't speak and you must come out.
Yeah.
And understanding. And also, this goes back to education. I've been really lucky. And it's a shame I have to say lucky, but I've been fortunate to have really good partners in my life. So I would go to bed and have to set an alarm every 3 hours to change my period products. I would sleep on a towel and I would flood, and I would sometimes be in so much pain I'd be sleeping on the floor, so it was more uncomfortable, so that discomfort would distract me. And they understood, but you had that anxiety every time before you went to bed with someone who you hadn't been to bed with.
Yeah.
Are they going to be absolutely horrified by the pain I'm in, or to avoid being around them when on the first few days of my period, or most of my period, because I was so tender and in so much pain.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, if children are taught that this is a possibility, or the impact that painful periods can have, for example, they're not going to be like, ugh, when they meet it, you know, if they do, you know, and they'll be understanding about what the pain is like. That's how important education is. So it's not taboo for them. We as adults should not kind of be proud or defiant by chatting about our vulvas in a coffee shop. You know, it just should be normal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we spoke about this in a previous episode about how there's all these different names that people use to tell their kids about the body parts. And instead of just saying vulva, I mean, there were all sorts, what, fairies, flowers.
Very creative.
And anything and everything. Yeah. And it definitely...
They all instill shame, don't they? They all imply that there's something wrong with the actual anatomy or the actual word for it. And so we like to say vulva as many times as we can in episodes. So we wanted to ask you about, because I know you've talked about it in your book, how women from different ethnicities and cultures often struggle to access healthcare and advocate for themselves more than like educated white women often do. What are your thoughts on that, and what kind of advice would you give to people to try and improve that?
I think it's really hard. I obviously come from an ethnic minority, and it is just not spoken about in so many homes. And culturally, in some cultures, there is a fear that, say, for example, in the UK, the sexualization of teenagers is more obvious here, and sex is more accepted here as a teenager than perhaps in some other cultures. And it goes back to that idea about sex, though. There is a tendency or an option to avoid talking about it, because if you don't talk about it, then they don't know, and then they won't do it because they don't know about what they're going to do. So they wouldn't dare go venture into the unknown. Has anyone been a teenager? You know. So I think it's education. I think it's also, though, with adult women from many different cultures, because language barriers are a problem. I think I was told in one language that menopause was something like, it's in the book, I can't remember, but
it's something like the end of your life in your dried up prune, something like that. Like, it is.
Yeah.
Well, it's
better.
The culture has to change that. There is life after menopause.
Yeah.
There is good life to be had after puberty. Yeah. And I think if we talk about it as a whole, in a wholesome, healthy way, saying vulva is not rude. Being body positive, reproductive health positive in this country, it sets an example.
Yeah.
You know, when my parents came here in the 70s, an example was set that they would see people would go to the pub, for example.
Yeah.
Now, my mum doesn't really drink. My dad doesn't really drink. But seeing it, they would have had an impression that people who go to the pub are alcoholics and do nothing but go to that. They go to this house where all they do is get drunk. That's not what going to the pub is about.
No.
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Going to the pub is like, you may not even have an alcoholic drink. You can go and sit and have a chat. It's a sociable thing. But we exalt and celebrate our pub culture. And we've done that with something that could potentially be very negative, you know, alcohol drunken behavior. And good examples change the idea of that. And I think, again, if you think about women's health, puberty, sex, you do it in a positive, wholesome way. Of course, you know, things can go wrong, but do it in a positive, wholesome way, then we would be less scared about talking about it. I know it's a weird analogy. I know it is.
I get it. It makes sense.
Off the top of my head.
No, it does make sense.
We wanted to ask like a bit about flipping things. So periods are still taboo, and we've discussed that. I think there is definitely more information out there, and there's loads of charities doing lots of work. The Wellbeing of Women are doing a great promotional on it's not just a period. There's lots of different things that are out there. But we wanted to ask, while questions about periods seem still quite taboo, why do you think questions about fertility and having children are often asked completely directly? Like, you've got married, when are you going to have a next baby?
Societal norm, expectations, isn't it? It's the role of the woman. You got married so that you could have kids.
Yeah.
You got married first of all so you could have sex.
Yeah.
And then if you were having sex, well, the only reason you're going to have sex is to have kids, surely. And we just haven't let it go. And, you know, I do think it's changed. I would never ask a couple who've got together or, you know, who've been together for a while or who got married when you're having kids. Never. Mm. And there was a time 15 years ago that, you know, I probably wouldn't have thought much about it.
Yeah.
And now that change has come down because we know so much more about fertility. We talk about IVF. Having a fertility treatment is not seen as being a failure and going, you know, round the back to have some dodgy treatment that's cheating. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And or only if you're uber wealthy, although it is obviously very difficult to get IVF treatment, repeated IVF treatment on the NHS, you know, long waiting lists, etc. But I think we talk about IVF now and fertility treatment as a right, and which is great, rather than, oh no, you know, in some cultures, if you can't have children, people get a second wife or you're divorced, so that you're literally left on this as a spinster on the scrap heap and considered that way.
Yeah.
And menopause, you know, you look at the fairy tales, Hans Christian Andersen, whatever, and Brothers Grimm, the older women were, because they had grey hair, and postmenopausal, they were hags and withered and no use in society other than to be evil. And I think fertility is spoken about a lot more and considered private, personal, but I personally feel it's less taboo. You may have different views because you work in the industry, but as a journalist and someone who speaks about it and speaks openly to people who will say, yeah, we're having fertility treatment, my friends, maybe that's because they're, I know, maybe lots of my friends do have advanced education, a level of wealth, I don't know.
Maybe that's because you're so open with them.
Yeah.
Maybe. But you gather people in your likeness a lot, don't you?
Yeah.
In terms of your echo chamber or your friendship group. So
yeah.
I can't imagine having friends who wouldn't be, not tell me everything, you know, about their personal lives, but who wouldn't be comfortable to say if something was bothering them.
Yeah. I think it is changing. Like you say, it's definitely a lot better than it used to be. It's just a very interesting thing to think about why it's okay to talk about pregnancy but not periods. You know, they're two very interlinked things, and a lot of it comes down to that stigma associated with being a woman, having periods and having pain. We finally wanted to just ask you, we ask all our guests a very quick question, with sort of three pieces of advice that you would give to someone just starting out with the symptoms and the journey that you have experienced and you've been on. What would be your like three top pieces of advice for them?
If it's preventing you from being the best you can be, there is a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Recognize that. Life's hard enough without having to fight with that issue. Track your symptoms. Keep a diary. Know what is not going well. Know when you are in pain. Recognize you are in pain. Recognize the different levels of pain. Recognize how it is stopping you from living your best life.
Mm-hmm.
Write it down.
Yeah.
So book an appointment. You are able to book a double appointment slot with your GP. Tell the receptionist they are there to determine what you need. If you explain your symptoms, they will listen to you. They're trained to do that. They're there to help.
Yeah.
Go to your doctor and be armed with information. Make clear you want to come to a solution. When you are told things by your doctor, write down what your doctor tells you. I know this sounds almost patronizing, but I tell you, the chapter in my book that meant the most was the GP appointment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And when you are told or offered solutions, treatments, make people in your life aware.
Yeah.
It is not, you are not winning any prizes by getting through life taking the harder route or suffering the harder route. You genuinely aren't. Mm-hmm. No one is going to turn around to you and go, here's a promotion because you've suffered really bad period pains and you kept quiet about it. No. Here's more money for that, or here's a house. They're not going to do that. They're not going to pat you on the back. You're just going to put up with it and be really, really tired.
Yeah.
So, and really, really sad and really upset and really thinking that you don't do woman as well as other women do.
Yeah.
I spent a lot of years doing that. And we have enough crap to deal with.
So true.
Protect yourself. Protect. You deserve to protect and protect yourself and be the best you can be.
And by doing that, you're also protecting other women, because then you're setting a standard. It's not okay to experience that. And advocate for yourself. Thank you so much. That's amazing. It's been so great to hear your perspective on things. And thank you for giving your time up to join our podcast.
Yeah. Our usual thing now would be like, have you got anything that you'd like to ask us? And then I'm like, you probably got nothing that you'd like to ask us.
I do have a question for all of you. One, thank you for all the work you're doing and all the research you're doing. Are you finding it easier to be heard in terms of getting funding and getting and being encouraged to do the research you do, or is it changing at all?
I would say, no, definitely don't find it easier. I think as you go through your career, it gets harder and harder. Mm-hmm. I do see that there is a culture shift, and there are more calls now specific to women's health for funding, and that is really positive.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it hasn't quite yet trickled through to make a real difference, I think, for my research anyway.
No.
But
still,
I see, I'm optimistic.
There's still silly barriers, like you go to a research panel and they're like, oh, you can't use tampons. What, we can't use a product that people use like every month of their life? Like, why can't we use that in research? Oh, people wouldn't want you to use tampons. Like, just like really, really barn door silly things. You can't ask people about their sex life. Well, that's actually part of our job on a day-to-day basis, so why would we not ask that in research so that we can ensure that what we're doing is helping people? Like, it just blows my mind that, like, I think a lot of, like, ethical boards and that kind of thing haven't just moved with the time. And we promise we are trying. We're trying to push back. And the podcast isn't about our research lives, in a sense. It's all about advocating for women. And I want women, when they come to appointments with me, I want them to have a list. I want them to be like, right, I've looked at all of these and I want to know what the best option is. But also, why do you think that would be a bad option? And I know about this and I know a story about that. Put me on my spot. I'm happy for that.
Yeah.
I want you to be able to kind of come and have an open conversation, rather than you come in and half being able to explain what's happening and not having a clue what the options are, because inevitably then I feel like...
But that's still okay.
Yeah.
Because, some of us have the tools to do that research confidently, and some of us don't, and don't have the time.
Yeah.
And don't, and you can get lost in a huge internet rabbit hole, can't you?
Definitely.
So it's okay. I think it's okay to not know what your options are, as long as you know what's going on with you.
Yeah.
And as long as you then are willing to take, once you're given options, to go to say, right, let me take this information, and then can we have a follow-up appointment?
Yeah.
And then I can talk to you. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
I just think that we shouldn't have the pressure to have any answers, but we should have the evidence.
Yeah.
We can do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think things like your book and our podcast are really good for starting these conversations and keeping them going.
Yeah, definitely.
Hopefully.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah. Oh, it's been great to have you on. Thank you so much again. We really, really appreciate you giving up your time.
I feel like we all look like bridesmaids.
Yeah,
we do.
I said that.
Who's getting married?
I'm so glad that we've colour coordinated. They look great online. So thank you very much, Naga, for coming on. It's been brilliant to have you on the podcast and great to hear your experiences again firsthand.
Thank you all very much for the inspirational work you're doing and fighting for us as well. So it's been a joy talking to you. Thanks.
So that was a fun episode.
That was so much fun.
I'm glad that we had her on. I think that we went through everything that we wanted to go through, because we discussed advocation at length, and we also discussed her journey, which I think were the main points that we wanted to get over. I mean, we did want to discuss Strictly Come Dancing, but we didn't get onto that.
But I feel like we got life advice instead.
We prioritised women's health over Strictly Come Dancing.
And we even all matched
and with Naga. So
yeah. Yeah, I'm a bridesmaid, so I don't know whose wedding it is.
I love the fact that she said that we look like bridesmaids. That was a winner.
We could just all go to a wedding next weekend in these outfits.
Is this a weather?
Got it.
Yeah.
Gosh,
someone
went no, easy. But yeah, so a quick disclaimer, everything we've discussed in this episode are our own opinions, shouldn't be taken as personal medical advice and are not affiliated with where we work.
Yeah, and if you've enjoyed it, found it interesting, want an invite to the wedding, then leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
And it may seem like a little thing, but giving us a 5-star review really pushes the podcast, and we want to break barriers, bust myths, and give really good information out.
And we want the podcast and the episode to reach as many people as possible. So if you want to be part of that ripple effect, then please hit the like button.
And make sure you're engaging with all of our content on social media and following us on all our platforms at Between Two Ovaries.